from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, why California water managers are worried about global warming and why climate change may lead to some uncomfortable choices for people along the coast. Also, how LA reacted when left-wing activists pushed for racial equality in the 1930s and 40s.
LA is shocked, first of all, to have to address race at all, but then for the communists and other leftists to say, we need to create a city in which racial groups are treated equally. That's too much for many Angelenos of the time.
Also, why a city best known for crime is preserving its past, and in Sonoma County, combining art with cremation.
They want something that is whimsical, or is serious, or is very somber, or it's just very quiet, it's just going to sit in some shelf somewhere and nobody's going to notice.
It's the California Report. Well, this week in California, the global warming issue was harder to avoid than Britney Spears gossip. Al Gore was in Silicon Valley talking up high tech's role in slowing down climate change. Attorney General Jerry Brown announced he was pressing ahead with a lawsuit against automakers whose vehicles spew out harmful emissions. At UC Berkeley, Governor Schwarzenegger announced that a consortium led by Cal scientists won a $500 million grant from British Petroleum to develop alternative fuels.
Now, thanks to UC Berkeley and BP, we will be the world center for biofuel research. And the work that is done here will put these fuels into the mainstream as soon as possible. Because California is not waiting for clean energy revolution. No, we are actually the leaders in that revolution.
And in San Francisco this week, there was talk of how global warming could affect one of the more mundane aspects of city management, sewage treatment.
I think it's still the case that most people I talk to really don't have much of an idea of what happens once the water goes down the drain in their house.
At a waste treatment facility not far from Candlestick Park, Tom Franza of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission is talking about water. Franza is in the sewage business. He oversees the city's wastewater treatment system.
So what this tank is doing is it's settling out that biomass. It's sort of a big decanting tank, if you will.
Franza is worried because, thanks to global warming, ocean levels are rising high enough on some days to get into huge water intake systems designed to carry only runoff rain and wastewater. That's a problem because if salt water gets into the waste treatment system, it kills the tiny microbes that break down biological waste. Tom Franza was one of hundreds of people who participated in a summit of water managers this week in San Francisco. Officials from California and the West gathered to share information and develop plans to deal with global climate change and to listen to people like Will Travis, executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, sound the alarm.
In many ways, we're in the same position as the captain of the Titanic was. At the speed he was going, by the time he saw the iceberg, it was inevitable that he would hit it, no matter what he did.
Travis said the die is cast, that global temperatures will continue rising for at least several decades. He had maps showing how rising ocean levels could affect the coast of California.
San Francisco won't become the Venice of the West. Silicon Valley won't become the lost city of Atlantis. And salt water won't come out of the taps in Southern California. Why? Because however much it costs, we can't afford to allow this to happen.
There was lots of talk at the summit about what water and utilities managers along the coast can do to plan for global warming and how to avoid its worst effects. But at this point, they're still figuring out how to get more data and then what to do with all that information. Water expert Peter Glick with the Pacific Institute has been warning about climate change for decades, and he's growing impatient.
I'm thrilled with the fact that climate change is receiving more and more attention. I'm still not convinced that it's receiving enough action. We've known for 20 years that sea level is rising and is going to rise and it's going to threaten flooding, coastal developments, our water supply. We've lost a lot of time.
Glick says California has failed to integrate water planning with land use planning and is now paying the price for that.
The flood risk in the Central Valley, for example, now is much more than it would have been if we had changed the way we build subdivisions in the Central Valley a decade ago.
So homes near the Sacramento Delta are at risk of flooding, but so are some airports, parts of Silicon Valley, and expensive homes in coastal Los Angeles and Santa Barbara County. Glick and others at the summit say not all the vulnerable land and structures can be protected from rising sea levels.
We're not going to spend billions of dollars to build levees to protect the vulnerable marshes around the edges of the bay. We'll build the levees around the city of San Francisco and around the airports, but we will not build levees around the ecosystems. And I'm worried that those remaining marshes and important ecological areas are going to be particularly vulnerable.
A debate about which parts of the coast are worth protecting worries people like Mary Nichols. She's director of the UCLA Institute for the Environment.
Is it really acceptable in a democratic society that we would sacrifice whole areas? I would think at a minimum, if you're looking at something like what we all saw on television with the response to Katrina and the horrendous effects that it had on poor people, mostly people of color, we wouldn't consider that to be acceptable in California.
Still, Nichols and others at this week's conference were optimistic.
Once people set their minds to trying to find solutions, they can come up with technologies that are both more effective and less expensive than people predicted at the beginning. So that by starting now, we can in fact shape the future and make it less horrible than we think it might be.
Getting to less horrible than we think it might be isn't exactly setting the bar too high, but it's a start. So what's the first thing that comes to mind at the mention of Los Angeles? Hollywood, maybe, or perhaps traffic. But a bohemian movement? Not so much. A new book about early 20th century L.A. could make you think again. It's called Bohemian Los Angeles and the Making of Modern Politics. Author Daniel Hurwitz traces the city's left-wing culture from roughly 1910 through the 1950s. The focus is a part of Los Angeles now called Silver Lake and Echo Park. Back then, it was known as Edendale.
Edendale, compared to the rest of Los Angeles, felt like a kind of rural outpost on the edge of the city. Where the rest of L.A. was laid out with a grid of streets, Edendale was a hilly neighborhood where some streets were incredibly steep and difficult to drive. People still were raising farm animals on their properties at the start of the century, or people were camping out there often. And this kind of rural setting made the neighborhood a magnet, initially for film studios at the very start of the film industry, looking to have a place where they could shoot westerns and Indian movies. They could film in Edendale or nearby Griffith Park. And so it became a kind of magical place that attracted all these creative people.
Was it isolated because of its geography?
In some ways, yes. Eventually, the streetcar line began to move also through Edendale, but it was off the grid, literally. And so it became, for some people, in later decades, like communists and gay men and women, a kind of safe haven where new forms of community could be built.
One of the people who figures prominently in the book and who lives in Edendale is a man named Julian Elting, who was a vaudeville singer, very popular, very successful at that time. What is it about him that you found so compelling?
Well, Elting is an exciting character. He was a vaudeville star, celebrated not just in this country, but around the world. Nonetheless, the kind of performance that he gave is the kind of performance we don't think of as part of vaudeville, and that is, Elting was a female impersonator. He was one of the greatest stars of vaudeville, and he was celebrated for being a man who so convincingly dressed up as a woman that audiences were thrilled by him. Right away, that's a surprise to me. Here at the start of the 21st century, to think, wow, a century ago, essentially a drag queen was a national, international star.
What kind of reaction was there in Los Angeles in the teens and 20s and 30s to a performer like Julian Elting? Did he provoke any? I mean, Los Angeles at that time was not the kind of liberal city we think of today.
In a way, it was and it wasn't. Performers like Elting were quite successful in the city. Certainly in the 30s, part of my research uncovered the fact that there were female impersonators performing at nightclubs all around Hollywood and Los Angeles. But where you're right is that at the same time as the public were celebrating these figures, particularly in the 1930s, the police and the political leaders of the city began to move against these kind of performers and crack down on them.
At the same time that these kinds of performances and artists were flocking to Edendale, there was also the emergence of the Communist Party in Los Angeles. How did those two things merge and influence one another?
Well, there's an interesting relationship between the art scene in Edendale and the party. By the 1930s, as communists move out into the city and make really a community in Edendale, they become interested in developing their own rich culture. They saw culture as a way to invigorate people, to make them think about new ideas, and to inspire them into action. So the communists often drew on local dancers, local musicians, local performers to participate in their rallies, to lead songs at picket lines, to inspire people into action.
During the 30s and 40s, these artists, these political activists, began to promote the idea of racial equality in Los Angeles for blacks, Negroes, Latinos, and Jews as well. How radical did that seem at the time?
Well, for Los Angeles, that was extremely radical. Los Angeles has an interesting history compared to other cities in the country. At the turn of the century, the city has a population of something like 100,000. It's a fairly small city. By World War II, it is one of the top five cities in the country. So it grows incredibly fast. There's a massive in-migration of African Americans. There are concerns about Japanese and Japanese Americans in the city and Mexican Americans. So suddenly, L.A. is forced to think about race. The communists say, well, we need to start thinking about creating racial equality in our city. And L.A. is shocked. L.A. is shocked, first of all, to have to address race at all, but then for the communists and other leftists to say, we need to create a city in which racial groups are treated equally. That's too much for many Angelenos of the time.
Given all these things that were going on in Los Angeles during the time of this book from roughly 1910 through the 1950s, why do you think L.A. is so rarely thought of as the cradle of bohemian thought or political movements in the United States? It's completely overshadowed by cities like, say, New York or San Francisco.
It's a great question, Scott. The history of L.A. in general has been overlooked. But I think part of the reason that it's been overlooked is that the movie industry has been so successful in convincing Americans that all L.A. ever had to offer was Hollywood. But I think L.A. really has made dramatic contributions to the country, and it's just only now we're starting to explore that.
Daniel Hurwitz is a professor of history at Montclair State University in New Jersey. His new book is called Bohemian Los Angeles and the Making of Modern Politics. Daniel, thanks so much for talking to us.
Scott, thank you.
Many cities in California are trying to redevelop their long-neglected downtown neighborhoods with new housing and retail stores. In Richmond, a city north of Berkeley long associated with crime and poverty, city leaders are redeveloping downtown with a nod towards the past. They're trying to preserve stories and memories of downtown Richmond's heyday. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
When you look at the decaying and boarded-up storefronts along downtown McDonald Avenue today, you can barely see evidence of the days when this was a major hub of the World War II homefront. On a walking tour through the heart of Richmond's blighted downtown, historian Donna Graves holds a graying photograph of a bustling retail and entertainment district, and there's a banner stretched across the avenue announcing a dance scheduled for December 6, 1941.
This was the night before Pearl Harbor was bombed and the night before Richmond was changed forever. It went from a community of about 23,000 people to over 100,000 in less than 2 years.
The war transformed Richmond from a sleepy rural town to a thriving city, crammed with tens of thousands of people who came from all over the country to work in the Kaiser shipyards. But when the war ended, the shipyards were shut down virtually overnight. Yet the city planned for the post-war transition, and McDonald Avenue remained a vibrant shopping strip.
You can see how great and alive the street looks with all this traffic and the neon.
Historian Donna Graves holds another old photo.
This is 1959, so it's almost 15 years after the end of the war, and it's still really a happening street.
The stories behind these photos are being retold and collected as part of a collaborative project between the city, local community groups, and Richmond's National Historic Park, honoring the World War II homefront. These memories of McDonald are poignant, nostalgic, and sometimes funny. Betty Reed Soskin of the National Park Service reads this anonymous account from a former resident who recalls when there were a half dozen movie theaters along McDonald Avenue.
We sat in the front row. Three men came and sat next to my friend. One man began to comb his hair until it covered his forehead as he smiled at us. The lights came on, and the man who usually announced the winner of the groceries came on stage and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, may I present for your enjoyment the Three Stooges." The men who had been sitting next to us ran to the stage, did their comedy act. It was Larry, Shemp, and Moe.
These recollections will ultimately be stored at the Richmond Museum of History. It's where residents recently gathered to share and record more stories. Ron Nielsen recalls a car cruising scene along McDonald Avenue in the 50s and 60s.
McDonald was a sea of kids in their cars, and at this time it wasn't just a Toyota or something. It was a Ford that was lowered with flame jobs, and they were all chopped, and kids drove up and down the main, bumper to bumper, from 23rd Street to 1st.
Richmond resident Sandy Genser-Mack.
Every storefront had a business in it, and people came here to shop. There were no such things as malls, and people came downtown. Whatever you needed, it was here.
But many of the buildings and landmarks of downtown Richmond are no more. Like many cities in America, redevelopment, racial strife, and the rise of suburban malls spell doom for downtown. Historian Donna Graves.
And I think what people don't understand is that it's not just Richmond's problem, this kind of downtown desolation. It happened across the United States. Federal policies and state policies were really supporting development at the outer ring of cities and counties at the expense of this kind of downtown.
But now Richmond is planning a major facelift of downtown, spurred on by the booming Bay Area economy. And that's all the more reason, says Park Ranger Naomi Torres, to preserve the stories of Richmond's past.
With Richmond, many of the structures that tell the full stories are gone. What's different about this is that the stories take the prime place.
Torres says the city and Park Service hope to preserve some of the memories of McDonald as permanent historical markers in a revitalized downtown Richmond. For the California Report, I'm Richard Gonzalez.
In a state where the funeral industry is a billion-dollar business, entrepreneurs have long sought a piece of the action. In Sonoma County, one art gallery in the town of Grayton is carving a niche for itself by combining death with fine art. Colin Berry attended the gallery's opening and brings us this report.
The inaugural show at Art Honors Life Gallery looks and sounds like a typical art opening. Well-dressed folks nibble hors d'oeuvres and sip lattes. Gallery owner Maureen Lomasny offers a tour of the dozens of smallish, beautifully sculpted art objects on display.
Well, this is a prayer wheel. It's clay. It's by Christopher Mensch in Bellingham, Washington, and it's based on the Tibetan Buddhist practice.
But whether it's a $700 porcelain vase with a garnet-tipped silver lid or a $1,000 hand-carved zebrawood box, each piece here serves to hold cremated remains of a human or pet. The first gallery of its kind in the U.S., Art Honors Life reflects a small but growing concept. Roughly a third of Americans now opt for cremation when they die, and most families scatter or inter their beloved's ashes. The rest keep them in vessels. A Nevada woman here at the gallery, who preferred not to give her name, recently lost her husband of 30 years to cancer.
The idea that we can have an art object, because I'm taking him home with me, so that I could have an art object in the home that isn't a constant horrible reminder because it's that ugly urn, you know, was very attractive to me.
This reaction is precisely why, in 1997, Lomasny first considered going into business.
And I started thinking, well, what are people doing with all the ashes? And I started looking online at urnmall.com and discounturns.com and saw manufactured products and ordinary boxes that were being used as urns. But they were very, very lacking in personality.
In 2001, Lomasny launched Funaria, an arts agency showcasing artists from around the world, and staged her first juried art show in San Francisco to promote her high-end urns. One of her jurors, retired art professor Adela Akers, says people are very choosy about the artifact that stands to represent them or their loved one after they're gone.
They want something that is whimsical, or is serious, or is very somber, or is just very quiet. It's just going to sit in some shelf somewhere and nobody's going to notice.
Art Honors Life caters to such a variety of tastes. One piece is shaped like a cigar butt, another like a vacuum cleaner. Lamassny pops the top on a metal urn adorned with a bouquet of antenna-like roses.
This little part comes out. It's a fitted lid with a little red ribbon that fits right down inside.
Quirky or elegant, the goods at Art Honors Life may reflect a viable new market, or maybe not. 50 miles south in Tiburon, Ron Hast publishes Mortuary Management and Funeral Monitor magazines and is a 50-year veteran of the funeral business.
The business of artful urns is certainly a niche business. It's nothing that would take on as a trend. It's nothing that would become a very noticeable standard in communities or places. It's just an option and it's an opportunity.
Still, Northern California cremation rates are among the nation's highest. And though specialty urns constitute a tiny fraction of the market, Lamassny's phone is ringing often these days with inquiries from crematories and funeral homes. Back at the opening, the Novato widow has opted for a bronze box with clean Japanese lines.
I looked at the pottery, but I thought that the metal pieces seemed more solid or something, and I selected that rectangular one because it seemed very grounded.
After she writes up the sale, Lamassny says she thinks of herself as a kind of intermediary.
I see the divine in other people, so this is my way of connecting the dots, you know, of being a conduit in a way to creating an environment where really creative people who are also skillfully executing beautiful work can touch the lives of other people who hunger for beauty and art.
To some, the objects at Art Honors Life aren't merely exquisite. They're unique vessels for something even more valuable. For the California Report, I'm Colin Berry in Graydon.
And that's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Tom Krimkowski, and Howard Gelman. Our producers are Victoria Malione and Erica Kelly. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org, and the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995.